From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents, context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Oh, I'm not from the Bay Area.
Pinole, California.
Pinole, California.
San Jose.
I'm from Paradise, California, up north.
Coming up, Ira Glass.
Let's take the stories basically from the daily news and public radio that everybody loves the most. Let's just make a show out of that stuff.
We meet the man behind This American Life and ask him some serious questions.
What I'm saying right now isn't even interesting. Like, this isn't even interesting, and yet you yourself cannot turn off the radio because you are a goner.
And we'll hear some Bay Area pieces from his world-famous radio show.
Where are we?
His name is Jesus.
The Wax Museum in San Francisco, in front of 13 life-size wax statues, recreating Leonardo da Vinci's painting The Last Supper.
It's This Bay Area Life. Stay with us. Today on our program, we hear how Ira Glass got into public radio at age 19.
In 1978, when I talked my way into an internship at NPR's headquarters in Washington, I literally had never heard it on the air or heard of it except as like an address of someplace to go look for a job. So I had no background. But also in 1978, nobody listened to public radio.
That's changed in part thanks to Ira Glass. The show he created and hosts has won every journalism award under the sun. It boasts 1.5 million weekly listeners, and he spends his days telling stories that have led him to television and the big screen. Act One, meet Ira.
Hey, Franklin?
I'm ready.
It's Ira Glass here.
You're the MC on the show, Ira.
I am the MC on the show, yes.
Oh, great. Ira?
Ira, I-R-A.
Oh, great. Now, hold on one second, Ira. Don't go away. Hello? Hilton, call me after 3 o'clock. I've got great news for you, Hilton. Ira.
Yes.
So, listen, Tony, if the phone rings, take it in the back and then tell me, then come out and tell me who it is. Just say Joe's being with a camera crew. Just for about 10 minutes. We'll do about 5 minutes, 10 minutes, right, Ira?
That's right. Well, you know what? Great thing about starting a new show is utter anonymity.
When it launched back in 1995, This American Life took the radio world by storm. Back then, it had a different name.
Name of this show is Your Radio Playhouse. I'm your MC. I'm your MC, Ira Glass.
But the purpose has stayed the same from the beginning, to talk to a lot of regular people and turn that into a show.
There was a kind of story that I liked doing at the time as a producer and a reporter for All Things Considered in Morning Edition. And if I had to describe it, I would say the stories, they had a great narrative momentum. There were strong characters. They were the sort of things where you couldn't get out of the car, right? And I just thought, like, well, you could make a whole show with stories like this kind of story where it just would have more feeling than a breaking news story can have. And then also at the same time, I was also producing David Sedaris' commentaries for Morning Edition. So David would write these pieces and I would record him reading them and put music underneath them. And I was like, you could make a show out of these two elements. And in fact, it seemed like such an obvious idea that at the time that I was trying to get together the funding for it, I really was scared that somebody was going to beat me to it. Like, it was the idea of, like, let's take the stories basically from the daily news and public radio that everybody loves the most. You know what I mean? Like, the ones that, like, you would talk about later. Well, let's just make a show out of that stuff. Like, why even bother with the news? Like, let's strip out all the other stuff and do that. And you really try to use the full power of what you can do in making an entertaining story. Because at that point, I had been working in public radio for 17, 18 years. And I felt like there was a kind of thing that you could do that would do the idealistic mission of public broadcasting, of getting voices on the air that you can't hear anywhere else, and stories on the air you can't hear anywhere else, and a perspective you can't hear anywhere else, but also take as its mission to be entertaining, like that it would be fun, that would be a show that first and foremost would be out to amuse itself and not ashamedly, like not as a kind of this is a side thing that we get to if we have time, but actually the primary mission of the show is it is an entertainment. Like if you listen to it, you're listening to it as an entertainment, but we'll do all these other things as well.
So this is going to take us to our first Bay Area This American Life story. It's from the earlier years, 1996, and it's one where you take a tour through the San Francisco Wax Museum.
Oh, wow.
While talking about Italian author Umberto Eco's contention that American wax museums are different from others around the world. So we'll hear a clip.
Now back to Jesus. The following description is alleged to be derived from an ancient manuscript sent by Publius Lentulus, president of Judea, to the Senate of Rome. It reads, "There lives at this time in Judea a man of singular virtue."
Where are we?
His name is Jesus.
A wax museum in San Francisco, in front of 13 life-size wax statues, recreating Leonardo da Vinci's painting The Last Supper. In this act of our program, rather than use the Michelin Guide to Tour America, we're using Umberto Eco's essay, Travels in Hyperreality. And in researching that essay, Eco visited no fewer than seven wax versions of The Last Supper between San Francisco and Los Angeles. Eco was fascinated with American wax museums, partly because he said that unlike wax museums in other countries, he says American wax museums try to reconstruct entire worlds with a kind of maniacal, chilling attention to detail. This museum, for example, runs 85 different soundtracks in its different rooms. There are scenes of wax figures bathing waist-deep in real pools of water. There's a full-scale reconstruction of King Tut's tomb. There are three-dimensional, life-size wax versions of a dozen of the world's most famous paintings. A typical exhibit in the World Religion section of the museum, Moses receiving the Ten Commandments on a rocky slope, eerie red light with flashes of white lightning.
I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. You shall have no other gods before me.
Eco had a name for these over-the-top production values. He called it reconstructive neurosis.
My name is Rodney Fong. I'm actually the grandson of the gentleman who opened this museum in 1963. It's my grandfather, Thomas Fong.
Rodney's family owns the largest wax museum in North America, which is in Los Angeles, and the second largest, which is this museum at Fisherman's Wharf. His family owned three wax museums visited by Umberto Eco when Umberto Eco wrote his essay. Rodney himself is an easygoing, friendly sort who grew up working in the museum shop after school, now 30 years old and the general manager of the place. And you might think that growing up in a wax museum would be kind of a fun thing for a kid, but he said that was not his experience.
Actually, I was terrified to go into the museum because my father always used the museum as a threat. If we were not good, we'd have to spend the night in the Chamber of Horrors. So actually, to this day, I still get the heebie-jeebies walking through by myself.
Rodney tells me we have to rush through the museum because there is so much to see. Over 300 statues, historical figures like Neil Armstrong and Geronimo, right next to fictional characters like Don Quixote and Alice in Wonderland. The juxtaposition is actually kind of, it's kind of dizzying. And Umberto Eco talks about this odd feeling you get in a place like this as a spatial temporal haze, where centuries get confused. One room, for example, depicts a dozen people at an outdoor cafe.
Mark Twain.
Smoking pipe, looking very stern.
Rembrandt. Caruso. Andy Warhol.
In a leather jacket.
Yeah. Whistler. Beethoven.
And we're back with the host of This American Life, Ira Glass. Ira, do you remember that?
I do remember it. It was Sarah Vowell went with me on that walk through the wax museum. She lived in San Francisco at the time, and I think it was her idea.
And any fond memories you have from that day or from that episode? What is San Francisco to you when you come here?
My sister lives here, and my nephews are here, and so when I come here, I get into the city a little bit, but mostly I see them. And so that's what it is. Like, truthfully, I don't know the city so well. I mean, I like it here. That's a terrible answer. That's just like a terrible. Yeah, I feel like I feel like anyone listening to me right now knows 1,000 times more about San Francisco than I do. You definitely do. Like, I have no particular insight to bring to the world of San Francisco, and that's what's great about a radio station that's locally based, is that you can have people from KALW reporting in an expert way on what's happening here locally, and you don't have to depend on an Auslander like me to come in and make big general statements that will have no meaning at all.
Act 2, Anatomy of a Bay Area Story.
What's the flavor of stories you get out of the Bay Area of San Francisco? What that you noticed might be different from other parts of the country?
They conform to no pattern. Like, truthfully, like, this is a big enough city that there are all kinds of things that happen. Like, one of my very favorite stories that we've ever put on the show happened outside the city, and it was about a guy who wanted to start a private detective agency. But it wasn't going to be any private detective agency. All the detectives were going to be MILFy soccer moms, and that turned out to be a front for a criminal enterprise where he and the cops were basically, it was like a drugs and money thing, which in its turn, so the private detective agency was a front for the criminal operation, which in turn was a front for his real goal, which was to get his own reality TV show. And I feel like that was a really amazing story that a reporter here in San Francisco brought to us. And we kind of did a cover version of a magazine piece that he had done and went back and found the people and, you know, interviewed them for the radio. And just a really wonderful story. But it conforms to no pattern. Like, I feel like you can't infer from that anything about in the Bay Area. Like, that would be just really weird to say, like, and this completely characterizes what you'll find. And you're like, that would be insane. I feel like if anything, like, everything we've done here in the city has been so varied.
So let's take a listen to a clip from that story you were mentioning earlier.
So one Thursday, Pete Crooks goes down to the PI Moms HQ. He introduces himself, gets some background interviews, and meets the moms and their boss, Chris Butler, the man at the wheel of this minivan full of suburban spy gals.
Chris met me at the office, and he was Mr. Cool, like, right out of a TV show. In fact, I walked in and I saw there were framed 8x10 photos of, like, Columbo and Cagney and Lacey and Magnum P.I., Charlie's Angels, all the 70s and 80s private eyes from television.
Chris actually was an ex-cop. But he parted ways with official law enforcement because, as he described it on his website, his bosses, quote, had trouble understanding his tactics and drive, which were well above the standards of routine performance.
And then there was Chris, who's this kind of puffed up, sort of burly guy with a blonde goatee and like a very tight black sort of motorcycle t-shirt, tight jeans, and very expensive leather boots. He kind of looked like a biker cowboy cop. His voice just didn't ever change octaves. You know, he definitely had this coolest guy in the room attitude.
Chris sat behind his desk, flanked by his posters and two PI moms, Charmaine Peters and Denise Antoon. Pete had seen them all on the TV segments. And then, to everyone's surprise, a client showed up.
Chris sees a luxury car pull into the parking lot right outside his office, and this woman comes in who has retained Chris to follow her fiancé around to see if he's fooling around. She comes in, attractive woman in her early 50s, and she explains the situation and tells me how long she's been engaged to this man and where she met him, and over the past 6 to 8 months, she's just really noticed that he's becoming more distant and that he goes to the gym on Saturdays and, you know, used to go for an hour and a half to work out and come home. Now he's gone for 7-8 hours at a time. And on one of these recent trips to the gym, when he came back, she peeked inside his gym bag and all his workout clothes were clean and neatly folded. She was composed, and then she starts crying and saying that she just needs to know if there's some funny business going on, you know, she needs to know now because this is a big point in their relationship.
It's like the opening scene of practically every detective film ever made. Nice-looking lady walks into the PI's office with tears in her eyes. Except this one has a PI mom's twist.
When the client starts to cry, one of the PI moms jumped up with a box of tissues and the other one said, "Do you need a hug?" And they had this sort of bonding moment, the two PI moms and the crying client.
The client suggested the following Saturday for the stakeout. Charmaine and Denise were ready with their surveillance minivan, prepped with recording devices and the subject's photo and address. Pete sat in the back taking notes. Sure enough, the fiancé quickly appeared. They followed him to a 24-hour fitness where Denise and Charmaine videotaped him going in.
Within 10 minutes, he came out of that same front door of the gym dressed up in this sort of Tommy Bahama's leisure wear, like khaki slacks and dress shoes and a short sleeve, a sort of dressy shirt. And Charmaine said, "Oh, don't we look pretty?"
And that was just the start of it. They tailed the fiancé to a gated community, where a young, attractive brunette appeared. She was half the client's age, buffed, glossed, and tattooed up her entire right arm. The couple got in the car, and the moms followed. Pete realized they were headed for Napa. The cheaters would spend the day wine tasting. Classy, Pete thought. But Pete started noticing a few things. He was no pro at clandestine reconnaissance, but he did wonder at times about the PI mom's strange technique.
We've been following him from his house to the gym, from the gym to the gated community, and from the gated community to the freeway, exactly one car length in the same minivan behind this guy.
When the fiancé turned, they turned. When he made a mistake and had to pull a sudden illegal U-turn, the moms pulled the exact same maneuver. At one point, the couple stopped at Starbucks. And if you'll just visualize this for a moment, the mommy minivan was right behind them, subject car and tail car, crawling towards Ice Mocha's, alone in a half-empty parking lot.
And I started to ask, you know, don't you have to hang back a little bit? And Charmaine and Denise said, no, you know, he's in his own little world there on his date. He doesn't even realize we're here.
Did you think that they were incompetent at doing this kind of thing? Or did you think that they in fact knew exactly what they were doing? When they reassured you, did you feel, oh, well, they've done this before?
I have to admit, I went along with it and thought, they've been doing this 5 days a week, and I've never gone on a ride along with it with an investigator before. And I just continued to record notes and go along with it.
Pete and the moms followed the fiancé and the mistress for hours. They watched them shop for discount jewelry and then move on to a Napa restaurant called the Rutherford Grill.
The subject and the mystery date park their car. We park right behind them. They walk right in front of our van. Denise is running a video camera through the front window of the van, and they stop right in front of the van to kiss. I mean, 5 feet in front of us.
So and Denise has a camera trained at them.
Point blank, yeah. A big, like, bulky camera, too, not some sort of hidden camera.
It was a lovely day, the kind of day that brings people out to Napa, and the restaurant was packed. Turned out the only place for the PI moms to sit was a communal table, where, as it happened, the fiancé was already seated, hoping to feed his mistress French fries. And so, the investigators and Pete wound up essentially having lunch with their targets. Again, Pete wondered if their cover could be blown by being that close. So close that Pete had to say hello to the mistress as they sat down and then listen to their lunchtime chatter.
Their conversation was lurid. The fellow kept saying, "Boy, you look hot today." She says, "Yeah, I'm hot. I'm sweating." And he says, "I'd like to lick that sweat off of you." And she goes, "Oh, yeah, I'd like that." But like just like without any passion whatsoever. And then she says, "I'm thinking about going horseback riding tomorrow." And he goes, "Yeah, where do you go horseback riding?" And she says, "Oh, I've got some friend who has the stables out in Bollinger Canyon." And he says, "Is that near where we got that hotel room that night? That was a wild night." So he always kind of turns the conversation back to sex talk, and she kind of goes off to talk about horseback riding or whatever. It's very bizarre, and it just sounded like you know, if this is what infidelity is, there's just no passion or substance to it whatsoever. And the client back in the East Bay is better off without this guy. Meanwhile, Denise and Charmaine were ordering burgers and ribs and not really paying attention to the conversation. And we all sort of scarfed down burgers and ribs, and it was just like, you know, a very casual lunch. And nobody seemed to be concerned at the, you know, awkward situation except myself.
I know. This sounds fake. And that's because it is fake. Fakety fake, totally fake. And the only person who doesn't know it's fake at this point is Pete. Everything else, the mistress, the crying client, the hot, hot horse ridey sex talk, the affair itself, has been meticulously choreographed by Chris Butler.
You just heard an excerpt from one of the many Bay Area stories that have aired on This American Life over the years. The episode was called The Incredible Case of the PI Moms. And this is a special edition of Cross Currents we're calling This Bay Area Life. I'm Hannah Baba. You're listening to Cross Currents, or as we're calling it today, This Bay Area Life, as we continue our conversation with This American Life host and creator Ira Glass. Act 3, This White American Life. I polled the staff as to what they would want to ask you. And one of the questions that almost everybody came up with is, why is This American Life not as diverse as America? I guess there's a feeling that basically that there's not much ethnic diversity in the stories. One person said it sounds more like This White American Life. And so I'm wondering if you've heard this criticism before, first of all, and like, how do you get your stories? Where do they come from?
The stories, first of all, I have heard the criticism before. I think the show could be less white. It could be more diverse, for sure. And periodically we run at that as a project, and we do, like, we try to take that on, and then we go into other things and we come back to it. And so at different points in the show's history, it has been more diverse and less diverse.
Like, it's a project that needs to be taken on. It's not like naturally that the stories that come to you are diverse.
No. And the reason why is because we're a program on public radio, and most public radio listeners are white. And most of the people who are trying to contribute stories are. Like, you know, like that's a lot of the people who make journalism and who are trying to get on the air. And so without actually trying to do it differently, like, that's the thing that will naturally happen.
Do you feel that there needs to be an effort towards kind of making calls out in certain communities or going into certain communities, like physically or online, or to be able to kind of get those diverse voices? Or,
I mean, I have to say, like, we do a lot of stories in non-white communities. You know, right now we're reporting stories in a Chicago high school where there have been a lot of murders. You know, in the last few months, we did an hour-long episode about a Guatemalan immigrant here in the United States and what happened to his family back in Guatemala when there were massacres there in the 80s. And if I could look at a list of stories from our show, I could list other things. Like, you know, we're doing documentary work. I feel like what we don't have is we don't have a base of contributors who are non-white. That's as large as we would want, you know? And so if you're asking, like, do I think, like, that's a thing, that's a project that's important, I absolutely do. And it's something we could be doing a better job at.
What are some other radio shows you listen to? Public radio shows?
I listen to Fresh Air. I listen to Radiolab. I'm a huge Radiolab fan. I listen to Glenn Washington's show.
Snap Judgment.
Yeah, which I feel like with Radiolab and with Snap Judgment, I feel like those are people who heard our show, and then they're like, well, let's do something that takes the lessons of having heard our show, and then let's do something that's completely their own, that's so they own and is so their own.
You feel you've inspired them?
I'm not sure if I feel like inspired is a little strong, but I feel like they observed that, like, okay, this kind of story can work on the radio, and now what kind of story do I want to tell, I think is a better way to say it.
you've mentioned some Snap Judgment and Radiolab radio programs that are considered innovative. And I'm wondering, like, to you, to what extent is innovation okay in radio? How far can we go without losing the essence, if that's a word, to describe this, of radio? Like, what is the essence of radio to you? And is there a fear of losing it with more innovation, or does it get better?
What do you think the essence of radio is? Like, what does that mean?
Like, is there an idea? Is there a feeling to radio that, you know how old people say, don't mess with it, it'll, you know, don't mess with something or don't add to it, you'll ruin it. Do you get that feeling with radio, or do you feel that, you know, whatever takes us forward, and that's cool?
Like, I don't worry that we're going to break radio. Like, I just don't, I don't worry about that. Like, I think innovation is really important. I think if anything, especially in public broadcasting, part of the mission of public broadcasting is to innovate. And it's part of our mission that we do the worst at. I mean, we do great with covering the news and analysis and things like that. And what we do a terrible job with is innovation. The Fox Network is more innovative in any given year in creating series. You know, Bravo is more innovative in any given year creating series. You know, the big shows on public radio have been around for decades. All Things Considered has been around for decades. Morning Edition, Prairie Home Companion, Fresh Air, our show's 17 years old. You know, like that just shouldn't be. There should be new things coming up all the time. And that's how you get new voices on the air. I mean, lately there's been this thing where Car Talk is going to be in reruns. They're not going to make any new episodes of the show Car Talk, but most stations are going to keep it on the air, and they're just going to play old. So then I just feel like, well, no, they could get out of the way and make room for Radiolab or for Glenn or for something. You know, just like they could do that. You know, that's prime real estate. A lot of people listen to the radio on Saturday morning, and I feel like that's you know, that's where, you know, you need your farm team to get in to be able to, you know, get in and play. And so I think that's one of the big failures of public radio and public TV. You know, and one of the problems is the funding model. The way that it works is that unlike commercial broadcasting, there isn't a program fund. Like, if you want to take your show national, there's nobody you can go to say, like, okay, we're doing great. We, you know, like we have this great audience. Like, you know, we're ready to go national. Like, and there's nobody who can say, like, listens to it and says, like, that's right, you're ready, and then can write you a check. Like, you have to go out and then find the funding yourself. And it can be really difficult, you know. And if you have an idea for a show, you have to invent, you know, find the funding yourself. And I think it stifles, you know, the funding model stifles innovation.
That's This American Life host and creator Ira Glass. I'm Hanat Baba, and this is a special edition of Cross Currents we're calling This Bay Area Life. Act 4, Cinematic Radio.
I fell asleep watching the news, you know, and it was sort of a, you know, a story about war and something very chaotic, and I fell asleep, and I had a dream that there was a guided missile headed towards my room, and there's all these military personnel in the room with me, and I jump out of bed. And I'm like, what's the plan?
That's comedian Mike Birbiglia telling a true story that happened to him. It's been a one-man show, a stand-up routine, a book, and now it's a movie.
There's one more thing. The missile coordinates are set specifically on you.
The film is called Sleepwalk With Me, and it was produced by Ira Glass. He also co-wrote the screenplay.
It would seem to me that filmmaking would be harder than radio when, you know, radio
is
only audio, and in film you deal with so much more. But then in radio you have to really describe things more accurately and kind of imaginatively so the listener can close their eyes and see what you're describing, which is also hard. What's harder?
Film is definitely hard. There's no contest. Like, and maybe I'm just used to making radio, so it seems so simple to me. But even making the screenplay in a form that it would work, and then And then, you know, and then you readjust the screenplay when you figure out how much everything costs and you rewrite to accommodate your budget. And then you have to find, in this case, $1 million, like, which turns out to be like a really hard job, finding $1 million. And then in order to make the film, and then the actual shooting process is grueling. And, you know, it just, it's so much harder. Like I'm, you know, it took 3 years to make the film, and the film's, you know, 80 something minutes long. You know, I mean, you know, we make over 30, 32 hours of stuff a year on the radio. And so, you know, and for much less money. And, you know, I mean, it's a very, very difficult and unforgiving medium, film.
And taking something that was on the radio, a radio story, what was the process like to take something that was on the radio and turn it into a film?
I mean, the first step was to begin lying.
Lying.
So, yeah. So we changed. Yeah. And we knew we were going to have to. So, for example,
make it into fiction.
Well, it's funny. All the incidents in the story happened, but to make a film, they wouldn't work in the order that they happened. So, for example, in real life, Mike Birbiglia is a comedian, and he had been sleepwalking from the time he was a teenager. Well, that's no good for a film. In a film, what you want is an incident that starts him sleepwalking. And so the film kicks off with he's at a party, an engagement party for his sister, and people are asking him, hey, what are you doing with your life? Like, how come you're not getting your career together? Are you going to marry this girl? Like, and it causes anxiety. And so he has his first sleepwalk dream.
So the plot is starts differently.
So it starts differently. And then the ending of the film, I mean, this isn't a spoiler. It's on the poster. Like, the tagline for the film is a comedy for anybody who's ever had a dream and then jumped out a window. And so he has a series of sleepwalking dreams over the course of the film caused by his anxiety over what's going on in his life. And they get bigger and more spectacular. And they culminate in this sleepwalk dream where he in real life jumps out a second story window and nearly dies. And that really happened to Mike. And in real life, he has this whole situation going on with his girlfriend that he's got to resolve. And in real life, the two of them figure out what they're going to do months before he jumps through a window. And Mike did a one-man show. He wrote a book where he recounts the true story. And one of the things that we decided in making the film was, like, that is not going to be how it works in a film. I was like, look, I haven't made a film, but I've been to the movies. And I know that in a movie, if you jump out a window, you have to draw some conclusion from that. You have to have a new thought in your head because of that. And so obviously, after he jumps through the window, he has to, like, he can't resolve the situation with the girlfriend. He can't decide about her until after he jumps through the window. Jumping through the window has to make him decide. So that was the second thing we moved. And so from the moment that you try to convert a real story into something that can be a screenplay and that will feel right as a movie,
you realize it's something very, very different.
It's very different. Yeah. So, yeah. And that's probably the fun of it.
This Bay Area Life was produced by Martina Castro. Special thanks to our volunteers, Leela Day, Ashley Ann Krigbaum, Emily Gaddick, Nina Gensler-Debs, RJ Sloan, and Alyssa Kapnick. Our engineers are Chris Hoff and Seth Samuel. Casey Miner is our senior editor. Ben Trefney is our executive editor. Holly Kernan is our news director. A special thanks to our boss, Matt Martin, who makes it a point to personally rouse each one of us from our beds every single morning.
It's like wake up and smell the pledge room coffee.
And thanks to you, we're listener-supported radio. It's something we say at the end of every show, and we mean it. For This Bay Area Life, I'm Hannah Baba.
Which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on?
We are making these announcements to put to rest the notion that large marijuana businesses can shelter themselves under state law and operate without fear of federal enforcement.
There are some confused attorneys in the White House who need to hear the message that we are standing together for health care, we are standing together for our sick, and we are standing on the right side of history on this issue. Yeah.
I'm Stephen Short. Stay informed on developments in California's medical marijuana industry by reading my online Cannabis News Roundup. You'll find it under the News tab at kalw.org. Which side are you on?